Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over five recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top five countdown for the week. At number five, we have Italian officials stopping Kosovo-Albanian Daesh terrorists from blowing up the world-famous Rialto Bridge in Venice last week. Although the police busted the suspected attackers over a week ago, this event is still worth reflecting on for everything that it signifies. The paramount concern for everyone who heard the story is that Daesh is now actively targeting Italy. Though this isn't exactly news because the group had earlier threatened the country a few years ago in its Black Flag Over Rome manifesto. What's changed since then, however, is that we see that they managed to inspire operatives within the country to organize an attack, which was thankfully averted by the security services before anyone got hurt. Italy is an important target for Daesh for a few reasons, namely the fact that the Pope's home of Vatican City is in Rome, the country is historically associated with Christianity, and Italy was involved in the war on Libya and reportedly has some special forces on the ground there. Moreover, because of its location right across the Mediterranean from that war-torn country, it's a prime destination for all sorts of migrants, some of which could easily be terrorists, which are posing as refugees. In addition, Italy is known for its famous tourist sites, which attract millions of visitors from all across the world, thereby presenting terrorists with a multitude of soft targets to carry out high-profile attacks against. Extrapolating more broadly from what we know about this foil plot, there's the fact that all four of the suspects are Kosovo Albanians, who were legally living in Venice. This draws awareness to the Albanian migrant crisis, which preceded the Mideast one, though receives barely any attention to this day. Tens, if not hundreds of thousands of Albanians have left their home country and the NATO-occupied Serbian province of Kosovo for the EU, a massive movement of people which proves that those two areas are failed entities. Albania has always had a slew of problems, but Kosovo never used to be this bad, though it began to resemble its dysfunctional neighbor after the 1999 NATO war on Yugoslavia succeeded in turning it into one of Europe's drug mafia headquarters. It's not only narcotics and crime, but also radical Islam, which is contributing to the province's many problems, as is painfully evidenced by the arrest of the four Kosovo-Albanian Daesh terrorists. They're not outliers either, as many reports have come out over the past couple of years about how fertile of a recruiting ground Kosovo has become for terrorists. This is mostly attributable to its socioeconomic devastation brought about by the NATO conflict there and ethnic cleansing against Serbs, which in turn created space for Wahhabis and other fundamentalists to prosper. Albanians have a history of migrating to and working in Italy, so in hindsight it's predictable that the country would eventually become threatened by these sorts of terrorists. Still, I doubt that Italy can do anything about it because there are just too many Albanians living there, and nobody has any idea how many are radicalized. So they'll probably keep responding on a case-by-case basis unless they get brave and take systemic immigration measures to preemptively deal with this threat. The next one up is the secret Italian broker deal, which has just clinched with a bunch of tribes in southern Libya. Details began to emerge last weekend about how Rome played a pivotal role in bringing together 60 tribal leaders from southern Libya, though concrete facts about what was exactly agreed to have yet to be disclosed. The gist of the deal, according to the AFP which reported on it, is to get all sides to cooperate in ensuring border security in this porous and terrorist-prone region, understanding that it often serves as the gateway to Europe for the tens of thousands of sub-Saharan migrants that regularly attempt to make this dangerous journey. In the words of Italian Interior Minister Marco Minniti, quote, securing Libya's southern border means securing Europe's southern border, end quote, which shows that his country and the EU bloc which it's a part of both believe that their southern borders extend through the Sahara down to Niger, Chad, and Sudan. Building off of this point, for any prospective solution to be sustainable, no matter what the specific details behind it are, the EU can't waver in its commitment to Libya, meaning that this could set the pretext for the bloc to maintain a robust security and strategic presence in the country even after the conclusion of its civil war. Moreover, it will probably surprise many Europeans to know that their southern borders now extend halfway into North Africa of all places, and this could feed into rising Euroscepticism among those who believe that Brussels has tremendously overstepped its authority and fear that it's now trying to de facto incorporate new, non-Western and non-European members under the guise of combating illegal migration and terrorism. Italy's geopolitical position endows it with a natural inclination to take the lead in dealing with the EU's Mediterranean and migrant affairs, presumably in order to mitigate national security threats, but also to promote its own regional interest. The country also has an imperial legacy in Libya, which its decision-makers and strategists might believe gives it a privileged position in dealing with certain issues in its former colony. Hence why I took the initiative in clinching the border security deal with 60 tribal leaders on the inferred behalf of the EU. Whether Italy wants it or not, it's bound to get involved in North African affairs, though this might end up being too much for the country to handle if it gets drawn into mission creep, which is why it must keep its commitment to a minimum and attract multilateral EU and NATO support to sustain its efforts. Italy's proactive role in brokering the South Libyan tribal deal suggests that Rome will continue to play a strategic role in the country because of its self-interested need to stabilize the former Jamahiriya, which it ironically helped destroy at the beginning of this decade. Italy knows that it will collapse if 30 million Africans swarm into Europe within the next decade, just like the president of the European Parliament recently warned. But if you ask me, relying on tribal leaders to secure a distant desert border isn't going to cut it. It only represents a symbolic step in the right direction, but one which must be absolutely paired with substantial structural assistance if this forthcoming calamity is to have any chance at being averted. Third in our countdown is how protesters torched the Paraguayan parliament last week. Activists were furious that the Senate held a secret session on the last day of March to pass a controversial draft law which would allow incumbent President Horacio Cartes to run for a second term, something which has been constitutionally prohibited for Paraguayan leaders ever since the end of Cold War strongman Alfredo Stroessner's 35-year rule. The protesters quickly turned to violence, broke into parliament after overpowering the guards, and torched the entire first floor, which resulted in the police responding with tear gas and other measures, which regrettably killed one of the participants. The mainstream media reacted in their typically hypocritical fashion by casting the protesters as rioters, despite failing to do this with Venezuelans, whom they instead loudly applaud and hold up as heroes when they do the exact same thing. The reason behind these double standards is simple. The Paraguayan protesters were engaged in hostile activity against a pro-American government, while the Venezuelan rioters were doing the same to an anti-American one, which apparently made it okay. Another point of interest is that Chavez was condemned for changing the constitution to run for an extra term, and former Honduran leader Zelaya was overthrown in the Obama administration's first coup for wanting to amend his country's legislation just like Cartes just tried to do. Though the incumbent Paraguayan leader hasn't earned any criticism from American authorities for his plans. Before continuing, let me state loud and clear that I do not support violent protests, riots, color revolutions, or torching government buildings such as parliaments. But what I'm trying to highlight here is how and why the West took a completely contradictory approach to what happened in Paraguay as compared to what occurs in Venezuela from time to time. President Cartes is a close American ally who entered into office after the 2012 constitutional coup deposed former President Fernando Lugo, and his pro-business background and attitude has contributed to Paraguay acquiring the moniker of the South American China for its rapid economic growth, fed mostly by Argentinian and Brazilian companies, which outsourced their production to this landlocked country between them. From the outside looking in, one would assume that Paraguayans are happy folks who have nothing to complain about, but such a presupposition would be inaccurate, despite its macroeconomic growth on paper. Regular Paraguayans have yet to see the benefits trickle down to them in real life, and they're fed up with the rampant corruption, crime, and drug use in their communities. As the elite get richer, there's a perception that the average person is being left behind, and this has contributed to growing resentment against the present authorities. The people probably wouldn't have rose up and rioted if they had hope, whether or not it was misplaced, that they could vote a new leader into office next year. But they feared that Cartes' shadowy moves to ensure himself a chance at running again might have foreshadowed imminent voter fraud next election, which is why they responded as they did. For now at least, the lower house of parliament has agreed to delay any moves to advance the Senate's sneakily passed draft legislation, so long as negotiations are ongoing with the protesters. But regardless of what ultimately happens with this proposal, the controversy which it sparked speaks to the undying leftist resistance, which is still alive in South America, despite all the U.S.'s right-wing efforts to snuff it out over the past couple of years. Our runner-up is the talk that the U.S. has unfrozen its aid to the moderate opposition rebels in Syria and is working to gather them all into a new alliance. Al Jazeera reported that the U.S. is seeking to unify its disparate proxies in and around Italy, theoretically allowing them to converge into a single military and diplomatic force. The chances that this will happen, however, are very slim, since the American-backed jihadists are in a state of civil war with one another, which has had the devastating effect of dividing and diminishing their ranks. Nevertheless, it's estimated by some sources that there are still approximately 50,000 or so fighters in Idlib province, and even if some of them join together under the U.S.'s new initiative, it could bolster their on-the-ground influence as per Washington's designs. About those plans, the U.S. knows that the present phase of the war on Syria is rapidly drawing to a close, as Daesh is slated for defeat sometime later this year, most likely, and the dual diplomatic processes of Astana and Geneva hold the promise of eventually yielding results sometime thereafter. If the U.S. doesn't get its game together, then the only proxy forces which it can hope will achieve some sort of post-Daesh political gains would be the PYD-YPG Kurds, meaning that the Salafist project which it works so hard to promote and spends so much to sustain could potentially result in nothing. If the Salafists remain disunited, their patrons' political agenda will be much easier for Damascus to counter, though if they band together, they might be able to make a powerful stand in at least attempting to generate some favorable compromise from the legitimate authorities. I don't want to be misunderstood by any of you folks, so let me say it directly. I don't want to see this happen. I don't support this American plot, but I do understand what it's aiming for and why the U.S. is moving forward with it at this moment in time. The military phase of the war is giving way to the political one, and it's at international gatherings where the tables might turn, depending on who plays their cards right and how much backing each side has from the great power supporters. Damascus, Tehran, and Moscow have already agreed on the necessity to pursue a so-called political solution to the war on Syria, meaning that the country's two international protectors might not be willing to help it liberate each and every square inch of the Arab Republic's territory for whatever the reasons might be, whether it's to avoid a potential quagmire or whatever else. This means that some form or series of political compromises will probably occur, but Damascus will be in a much greater position to resist any Western pressure in going against its core interest if the so-called moderate opposition rebels are disunited and can be picked off one by one, whether politically, or if it comes down to it, even militarily as well. If they successfully band together under the U.S.'s new umbrella, which isn't likely but is reportedly being attempted, then they theoretically stand a better chance at getting what they want. Though the danger to everyone is that this new supergroup of jihadis might easily turn into Daesh 2.0. At our top spot, we've got the scandalous report that former National Security Advisor Susan Rice was behind the order to unmask intercepted information about Trump's campaign and transition teams. This story builds off of the earlier one from around a month ago when Trump alleged that the Obama administration spied on him and his team up to and after the election. And according to journalist and author Mike Chernovich, it was none other than Rice who played the crucial role in making this conspiracy a reality. He reported that she requested for the names of Trump's campaign and transitional aides whose communications were inadvertently picked up by the National Security Surveillance State, which she admitted to on a Tuesday interview with NBC's Andrea Mitchell. She did, however, vehemently deny that her actions were illegal and said that she isn't responsible if any of the information was later leaked. In one fell swoop and within the span of about 24 hours, Trump's claims that he was being spied on by former administration elements within the U.S.'s permanent military intelligence and diplomatic bureaucracies, or so-called deep state, was proven. And it's very likely that Rice is lying and actually did have something to do with the deliberate leaking of what Obama and his team might have felt could have been compromising or embarrassing information, with the goal of offsetting Trump's transition and enacting political damage against him. Rice and her defenders are pleading that she was doing her job and that we need to trust her, but I don't think that many Americans are buying that, especially not after she did a bunch of media rounds right after Benghazi happened and lied to everyone by claiming that the attack was an impromptu response to a fringe video. Personally, I believe that a very convincing case can be made that Susan Rice was Obama's chief operative in what's panning out to be a bigger cover-up and crime than Watergate by a lot. Remember, folks, the U.S. is supposed to be a democracy, or at least that's how it presents itself to its citizens and abroad, especially when it's justifying wars. Yet these allegations assert that it's really a deep state dictatorship, where shadowy national security forces conspire against democratically elected candidates and even presidents in order to manipulate the democratic process. Folks, You know what that sounds like to me? Every single unethical act that the U.S. accuses Russia, Putin's Russia, as it's fashionable to smear it as nowadays, of doing, is actually committed by the U.S. and hit a fever pitch under Obama's America, including the use of spy agencies to suppress political opposition and even currently to work behind the scenes in undermining the legitimate government. Democracy? Nope. That's a full-blown dictatorship. But to Trump's credit, he's trying to dismantle at least that part of it, for now. So folks, there you have it. This wraps up this week's Context Countdown, and as I always do, I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for listening to my program. Hope you're tuning in again next week. Thank you. Bye.